Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the March 12th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Last month, I played you a clip from the presentation by Victoria Nuland, President Obama's Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asian Affairs, speaking to an organization of Ukrainian Americans in Washington last December, in which she described the efforts that Washington has been making since the collapse of the Soviet Union to set up a friendly government in Ukraine on Russia's key southern border. The cost of this enterprise, she told her audience, had been $5 billion, a fact that has, to my knowledge, not been acknowledged or reported elsewhere in the mainstream media, nor that Victoria Nuland is the wife of Robert Kagan, one of the country's foremost neocons and co-founder of the Project for New American Century, or PNAC, as well as its successor, the Foreign Policy Initiative, which, like PNAC before it, has been able to function beneath the Washington Beltway's media radar. Kagan was also the leading foreign policy advisor to John McCain during his presidential run, and then shifted over to Hillary Clinton, where he serves on her Foreign Policy Advisory Board. Forgive me for repeating what I told you a month ago, but I believe it bears repeating, given the silence on the subject from Fox to NPR to MSNBC to Democracy Now! Nuland's role was inadvertently exposed when someone, presumably the Russians, released a surreptitiously recorded conversation that she was having with the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, which she concluded by using that four-letter F-word to describe her opinion of the European Union's refusal to take a hard line against Ukraine's democratically elected president at the time, Viktor Yanukovych. What the mainstream press that reported that story generally suppressed, and continues to do so, is the clear evidence revealed in that recorded conversation that the man who is now Ukraine's Prime Minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, or Yahtzee as she paternalistically referred to him, was Washington's man, their choice to run to replace the yet-to-be-deposed, at the time, Viktor Yanukovych as Ukraine's leader. Yatsenyuk, it seems, was the choice of the U.S. and International Monetary Fund to steer the Ukrainian economy through the shoals of what may prove to be the toughest austerity program forced on any European population yet. To avoid that outcome, which would have been part and parcel of the European Union's agreeing to accept Ukraine as a new member, Yanukovych accepted the offer of Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin of a $15 billion loan without an austerity program to carry over Ukraine's economy until better times. Ukraine's credit rating is worse increases, and large debts will soon come due, with some $15 billion sovereign bonds maturing this year, another $15 billion in 2015. With a current account deficit equal to 8% of its gross domestic product, Ukraine cannot pay off and refinance those debts without large-scale aid, some $35 billion over 2 years, the new government says. It is more than likely that many of those protesting in Kiev's Maidan or Independence Square were not aware of what awaits them. For the newly revived Ukrainian neo-fascist right wing, whose fighters in the Maidan Square were among the boldest and most violent in resisting the state apparatus, it might make no difference. Their long hatred of the Russians, which led many Ukrainians to side with the Nazis when they invaded the Soviet Union three quarters of a century ago, seems to be alive and as worrisome now as it was then. The Right Sector Party, as one of the fascist groups is called in English, is part of the new Ukrainian government, and it has succeeded in getting Russian outlawed as an official language in the new quote-unquote liberated Ukraine. That is one of the reasons that the largely Russian-speaking and ethnically Russian population of Ukraine's eastern region, Crimea, is likely to vote to secede from Ukraine this Sunday and choose to join the Russian Federation when a new Crimea parliament holds an election on Sunday. The outcome of that vote may determine whether there will be another war on the European continent on the 100th anniversary of what was to be the war to end all wars. To talk about all of that, and I'll be speaking at 20 minutes past the hour, with Ray McGovern, a now-retired 27-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency, who worked as a Russian analyst in the days of the now-departed Soviet Union. I have corresponded with Ray for well over more than a decade and have interviewed him several times in the past, but last week in Washington, I had a chance to meet and chat with him at the dinner reception that preceded the first national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship at the National Press Club, in which both of us, as well as several other former guests on this program, were speaking. Those others included Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, or IRMAP, and Allison Weir of If America's New, and Phil Giraldi, himself a former CIA officer and now president of the Committee for the National Interest, three of the summit's four sponsors, along with the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And there was Gareth Porter, who you heard two weeks ago, as well as Stephen Stagowski, a guest twice on this program. Another former guest, Michael Cahill, flew in from Tokyo to attend the program, which attracted over 300 guests, filling the Press Club auditorium, and was videoed live in its entirety on C-SPAN 3. You can still see all 8 hours of it by going to C-SPAN for March 7th and look for Israel-U.S. relations. C-SPAN's coverage was of extreme importance because none of the mainstream or alternative media that covers Washington made any mention of the conference, despite a stellar lineup of academics and former government employees who spoke of their experiences with Israel and Israeli issues while working for the government. My topic was how the gatekeepers of the left run protective cover for the Israel lobby, and you can see and hear me in my 13-minute talk at 25 minutes past the fifth hour. It sparked the only controversies on today's program. Check it out. There was nothing said on Friday which approached the speech that Secretary of State John Kerry made to the 14,000 attendees at AIPAC's annual policy in Washington a few blocks away and 3 days earlier. In fact, it was the very approach to Israel-U.S. relations expressed by Kerry and by the many elected U.S. government officials who have preceded him and behaved obscenely at these equally obscene events over the years that led to our one-day counter-conference on Friday. Early in his unusually long speech, and after acknowledging that AIPAC's work is in the best tradition of American democracy, Kerry said, quote, "I want you to know that in my judgment, these democratic values are stamped in the DNA of both the United States and Israel. But we also share something much deeper than that, like no other two countries on the planet. Against the deepest odds, both America and Israel confidently, purposely set out to be examples of the world. Think about it. From its earliest days," said Kerry, "Israel has always said it's not enough just to be one of many in a community of nations. Israel strives since Isaiah's time to serve as a light unto the nations," at which point he was interrupted with applause. "And that responsibility to be a light unto the nations," he went on to say, "sounds actually unbelievably similar to something that we as Americans know as part of who we are, too," end quote. That was the same John Kerry who threw his medals from Vietnam away to show his opposition to that war in which he had fought, or what we believed was his opposition, only to become part of a system in which making aggressive war on peoples who have not attacked us is part of this nation's DNA, as it is of Israel's. Not to be outdone, a week ago yesterday, the U.S. House of Representatives, by a 410-1 vote, including our Jared Huffman and Berkeley's Barbara Lee, demonstrated their affection for Israel and the all-important cash contributions of its supporters by approving House Resolution 938, the United States-Israel Strategic Partnership Act of 2014. I suspect none of you have heard about this bill, despite the fact that it represents an outlay of U.S. taxpayers' funds in the billions and virtually gives Israel a green light to wage war on whoever it wishes to in the Middle East. Sucking up to Israel is clearly in our Congress's DNA and will be until the American people put a stop to it. But that can't happen if they don't know about it. And neither NPR or AMI seems inclined to let them know. Here's an excerpt from the 23-page resolution. Quote, "It is a sense of Congress that, one, the United States and Israel should continue collaborative efforts to enhance Israel's military capabilities, including through the transfer of advanced combat aircraft, active phased array radar, military tanker transports, other multi-mission military aircraft, advanced or specialized munitions, and through joint training and exercise opportunities in the United States. Two, the United States and Israel should expeditiously conclude an updated memorandum of understanding regarding the United States security assistance in order to help Israel meet its unique security requirements and uphold its qualitative military edge. Three, the United States should ensure that Israel has timely access to important military equipment, including by augmenting the forward-deployed United States War Reserve stockpile in Israel, and by continuing to provide Israel with critical military equipment and spare parts through the Department of Defense's Excess Defense Articles Program. And four, The United States should continue to support Israel's inherent right of self-defense, end quote. The rest, before and after, is equally disgusting. The one member of Congress to uphold his oath to the American people and to the Constitution was Thomas Massie, a first-term centrist Republican from the 4th Congressional District of Kentucky. Senator Barbara Boxer, no slouch when it comes to protecting Israel, has introduced a similar bill in the Senate where it should sweep to a 100-0 victory. Among the estimated 14,000 attending the AIPAC conference last week were two-thirds of the members of Congress, 2,200 college students, and among them student body presidents from universities in all 50 states. They heard not only from Kerry, but from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and a bevy of U.S. senior politicians from John McCain and Eric Cantor on the Republican side to Charles Schumer, Robert Menendez, and Steny Hoyer from the Democrats. With implementing further sanctions against Iran topping its agenda, despite President Obama's current opposition to more sanctions, AIPAC's website carried the copies of two letters, one from House members signed by Republican Eric Cantor and Democrat Steny Hoyer, the House whips of both parties, respectively, and another signed by half-dozen senators equally split between Democrats and Republicans, calling on the president to allow Congress to have the final say in the negotiations with Iran. That position runs counter to its assigned role under the Constitution, a document that we see as of little consequence to our elected representatives when Israel makes its demands. If you find anyone who does not believe the U.S. Congress is Israeli-occupied territory, check and see if they're still breathing. And it probably won't make you feel any better to know that last night, while the New York media was looking the other way, the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces held its annual dinner at the Waldorf Astoria with Benny Glantz, the chief of staff of the Israeli Armed Forces, as its honored guest. If passed as prologue, the dinner will raise more than $25 million tax-exempt dollars for the rest and recreation of Israeli soldiers, but apart from listeners to this program, only readers of the Jewish press here and in Israel will find out about it. I'll let you figure out why. Meanwhile, CBS News reports that Obama administration officials want an end to the assassinations of Israeli scientists, which he evidently believes to be the work of Israel's Mossad, in order to give diplomatic negotiations with Iran a chance to succeed. A number of those scientists have been murdered in a campaign thought to be carried out by Israel's spy agency. Finally, I am sad to announce the passing in Oakland on Sunday of a good friend, Shaba Paloni, who produced and edited Left Curve, a fiercely independent annual of politics, fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and art that since its first edition in 1974 was unmatched in its integrity. Left Curve was, as Shaba said, quote, a premise on the recognition of the destructiveness of commodity systems to all life and the need to build a culture that could potentially create a more harmonious relationship among people and between the human and natural world, end quote. He had hoped to get the 38th edition of Left Curve to the printer this month, but the aggressive stomach cancer that attacked him and was diagnosed in December would not permit it. If you, his friends, myself among them, have committed ourselves to getting the last issue of Left Curve published, and you can see past issues of Left Curve, including articles of mine, by Googling Left Curve online.